Welcome back to Logical with Ludmila, where we untangle the legal knots so that you don't have to. I'm Ludmila Yamalova, a U.S. qualified lawyer based in Dubai. In each episode, we break down complex law into clear, practical insights that you can actually use. The topic of today's discussion is force majeure, a concept that becomes particularly relevant in times of economic and regional uncertainty. Recent developments in the Middle East understandably place pressure on both businesses and individuals. While there's always hope for stability, the reality is that many are facing operational disruptions, financial strain, and difficulty meeting contractual obligations. In response, the UAE government has introduced economic relief measures aimed at supporting businesses. These initiatives have provided meaningful assistance in certain sectors. However, for many others, the relief may not be sufficient to offset ongoing challenges. As a result, a growing number of businesses and individuals are now asking, can I suspend or terminate my contractual obligations? What legal options do I have to reduce exposure and liability? Is there a way to exit agreements and transactions with minimal penalties? This is where the concept of force majeure often enters the conversation. So before attempting to invoke it, it is important to understand what force majeure means in general, how it is applied under the UAE law, and critically, when it does and does not offer relief. So now let's talk about, in legal terms, the definition, the legal authority behind the concept of force majeure in the UAE. So in the UAE, it's a legal concept that exists in many jurisdictions. And in the UAE, it's derived from two primary sources. One is statutory, which is the law. So the book itself, where the concept of force majeure is described. And the other one is what's called the judicial interpretation. And that is once claims of force majeure or arguments of force majeure are presented to the court, you know, how the court view these specific statutory provisions and the meaning and the context that they gave to them. So from the legal framework, so first we'll start with the legal framework, and that is the statutory definition. And then we'll talk about some specific examples of how the courts in the UAE look at them, and perhaps I can even share with you some of the examples of force majeure being used by different parties over the course of my many years of practice in the UAE, just to kind of give an idea perhaps and some expectation of what may come in the future if this argument will be introduced more in courts in light of the current situation. So from the standpoint of the legal framework or the statutory framework, so it stems, the concept of force majeure exists in what's called the law itself, so the book. And then the law is what's called the UAE Civil Transactions Law. Now, interestingly enough, until recently, the UAE Civil Transactions Law is one of the very few laws left in the UAE that had not been amended in light of or in the context of the recent flurry of legislative amendments that started in 2020 during the COVID time and basically, for the most part, kind of transformed the UAE legislative framework by like 98%. So this was one law that actually had not really been changed until very recently. So the law itself, it was the original law is the Federal Law Number 5 of 1985, and it was amended later as well. But ultimately, the amendments are still related to that same law. Now, there is since then, a new law was introduced completely replacing that law, which is the Federal Decree Law Number 25 of 2025. However, that law itself does not come into effect until June 2026. Now, we're recording this podcast in April, so while the law is already in the books, it exists, and the law itself is dated to 2025, and we're already in 2026, the law itself is still not effectively in place or is not really. So if you were to argue the concept of force majeure today, I mean, theoretically speaking or legally speaking, you should not be necessarily citing the new law, the new civil procedures law or civil transactions law, because until June 1st, the previous UAE civil transaction law is still in place. That being said, so we'll talk about both versions of the law because the timing is so short. And as of June of a few months from now, the previous version of the Federal Law Number 5 of 1985 will no longer be a subject to discuss, but today it still is. So we'll talk about them both. However, effectively, there's no much difference because in both laws, the concept of force majeure is described in the same provision and in the same Article 273.1. It's in the old law and it's in the new law, and even the language of the law is the same. So what that tells you is that, A, the concept of force majeure existed even as far back as 1985, so it's not a novel concept in the UAE. And then B, even though all throughout all these years, and we've had plenty of years to perhaps bolster the concept if the legislators believed that that was necessary, it really hasn't been, right? So as of the 2025, that's basically a 40-year difference between the first version of the law and the second version of the law. The language that defines and sets out force majeure remains the same. So that just kind of tells you that the legislators, the courts, the country believe that the force majeure, as it's defined in the law and has been defined in the law, has worked well for the country and it's sufficient in the form that existed before. And perhaps that is the case because of how the courts have used it in over the years. So for our purposes, it's important for technical reasons to mention both versions of the law. But in terms of the language of the law, it's also important to kind of to keep highlighting that it's the same. And not only that, is there's not much in the law that defines or details what force majeure is beyond this one provision, which is, again, Article 273.1. And that particular provision states as follows. In contracts binding on both parties, if force majeure supervenes, which makes the performance of the obligation impossible, the corresponding obligation shall cease and the contract shall be automatically canceled. That's it. That's basically the definition, the legal definition of force majeure in the UAE. So although it's a very complex concept and it affects a lot of transactions fundamentally in terms of what it means in legal terms and how it's defined, this is it. What I've just read out to you is basically is the definition of a force majeure. That being said, it's not a very simple definition because there's a few specific elements that are important. And if you look at the language of the law itself, so it talks about performance of the obligation being impossible. So the word is impossible. We'll talk about that further. So that's one specific word or phrase to kind of keep in mind as we go through the process. And also the corresponding obligation shall cease because of this impossibility. So it's basically if something is impossible, that makes you have no longer an obligation to perform it because it's impossible, and therefore the contract shall be automatically canceled. So that's basically that's the same language that exists in 1985 version of the law and in 2025, 40 years later. Now, so the law does not really define what constitutes force majeure per se. It doesn't go through, like, for example, a list. Okay, so force majeure means that, you know, let's say the acts of God, the war, the strikes, and tornadoes. It doesn't have that list. This is it. So it doesn't go through the list of or examples of force majeure. Nor does it specify any kind of precise conditions required for an obligation to be deemed impossible. Right. So what I read to you is basically what we have to work with. Plus, however, the courts, the UAE courts, have interpreted this specific provision and how they've applied it in practice. So as a result, the criteria that kind of add on to the statutory definition have been developed through the UAE court jurisprudence over the years. Now, the UAE courts have consistently applied the following sort of cumulative conditions, right? And they are, first of all, basically, if you were to list them out at a high level, there's three conditions. One is that the event itself has to be unforeseeable. So the condition is unforeseeability. So it must not have been reasonably foreseeable at the time that the contract was entered into. Let me see. I was going to give you an example of what that may mean from my experience and my practice, but let me give that to you now, although we can talk about that specific example a little later in more detail. So, for example, and this has kind of come through my hands during my practice here. Back in the old days and during the financial crisis, a lot of developers and real estate companies argued, for example, that their subcontractors failed to deliver. And there are four, that was a force majeure. And the reason they said that was a force majeure because basically, you know, they, you know, that was just a contractor, it's just a third party. However, the courts had consistently argued that that's not something unforeseeable because in the business, when you're, especially in that kind of a business, in real estate business, when you're a contractor, you're a real estate developer and you work with all these contractors, with all the third parties. So basically, one of your subcontractors' inability to perform is a foreseeable event. Right, so that's an example of something that is, although it may feel like to the party that's trying to invoke that specific argument at the time that, well, listen, it's not my fault; it's a third party fault. But that's, you know, that does not fit the definition of unforeseeability in the context of the force majeure example. So that's so the condition number one is unforeseeability. Condition number two is the impossibility of performance. And this is really important because all the word in the law, as you recall, is just basically impossible, but it's a sort of fairly loaded term. And so what the courts have said is that the event must render performance absolutely impossible, not merely difficult or delayed or financially burdensome. And this is a big difference, and we'll talk about it. We're going to come back to the specific definition in specific context that we'll be discussing in terms of the economic industries that are being affected perhaps by force majeure currently. So the idea here, it's something that the performance has to be impossible to perform, but not just inconvenient or sort of financially burdensome. So that's a big difference. That's a big sort of big difference between the two. The two, I guess, standards, if you will, and the context of a lot of the clients and the questions we've already received, that's the one kind of, if you will, confusion that often arises, is that because somebody feels, well, it's really difficult for me to pay for this, therefore, you know, I should benefit from the concept of force majeure, but that doesn't quite qualify. So that's condition number one. So impossibility of performance, absolute impossibility. And number three is the direct link between the two. So the causation between the event being unforeseeable and the impossibility of performance. So there must be a direct causal link between the event and the inability to perform. So in other words, it's... because sometimes you can argue, well, listen, well, there's all these events going on, and so it's very difficult for me to pay the suppliers. And that may be so, but it's not necessarily the impossibility of performing specific obligation may not be, it may be impossible for you to perform something, but it may not be directly related to the event that you basically are now alleging is making your performance impossible to perform. Importantly, so all these three conditions, you know, the unforeseeability, impossibility of performance, and causation, they are cumulative. So in other words, all three must be satisfied. And it's not sufficient just for an event to be unexpected or disruptive, as I said, and the party ultimately must demonstrate that performance is objectively impossible and not solely or directly sort of caused by, it's the impossibility itself is solely and directly caused by the event, as I said. So in practice, the way the UAE courts look at this is that they apply the conditions fairly strictly. And the threshold for establishing force majeure is fairly high for obvious reasons, because ultimately what it gives the party that's trying to invoke it, so the benefit it gives is just the carte blanche to walk away from the obligation. So because the repercussions to the other party is so significant to the party of that transaction, that's why, you know, for obvious reasons, the courts have to apply conditions strictly, and the threshold has to be high. What's important, however, is that, as I mentioned earlier, because the law is fairly scant in terms of the definition, and the courts have applied these conditions sort of on a case-by-case basis, the application, or I guess the full definition of force majeure, is very, very much case specific. So it's very fact specific, and it's really determined on the case by case basis and at the discretion of the court. So it's not something like, you know, it's like if you had a definition, okay, the force majeure means 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, these are the elements, so that's it. So no, it really, really is very discretionary, and it's and for the court to determine, and it very much depends on specific transaction. So now one of the questions that have already come up from a number of our clients in light of the current events is that, well, you know, we're not able to perform this obligation. So we've got this contract and it's just there's no way we can perform it. However, we don't have in our contract the provision for force majeure. So therefore, we're not able to invoke it or try to benefit from it. So that's the question. In order to invoke or benefit from force majeure, must it be expressed in the specific contract or in the underlying contract? And the short answer is no. It does not need to, and that's because it's a legal doctrine established by law and not merely a contractual concept. So it exists independently of any contractual provision, and that's because, as I mentioned, so the legal basis is found in the UAE Civil Transactions Law and specifically, once again, Article 273.1, which governs the effect of force majeure on contractual obligations. So it is, you know, it's an independent legal right, and you don't need to necessarily have it in your agreement in order to try to invoke or raise the agreement. So it's even if your contract is silent on the issue and it does not so eliminate the right to invoke it. That said, if you know, and this, I guess the question will naturally follow it, well, then what's the point? I mean, then why do even contracts include force majeure? Well, I mean, this is why you have contracts in general. It's just because the more, if you have a well-drafted force majeure provision, then it takes away a lot of the ambiguity, right? It sort of increases certainty and kind of minimizes disputes, and it lists out the very specific elements of what the parties in their transaction, so based on their on the nature of their specific relationship, what they deemed would constitute or, you know, sort of event of force majeure. So it just reduces that kind of going back and forth. Well, that does not qualify. This does not qualify. So it's that's I mean, that's, I guess, the benefit of having a specific provision in the contract that, you know, helps to parties to sort of interpret the contract better, and obviously helps them to negotiate better, and ultimately also helps them to define remedies and consequences better. However, I'll pause there for a second as well, because, and this is important too, I anticipate in the context of what we may see coming, is that just because you have a very detailed force majeure provision in your contract that lists out every possible event, that in of itself does not make that sort of list of events of force majeure enforceable either or valid. So, and I have seen this in my practice, that this was quite common, and that going back to my example of the real estate developers during the financial crisis, almost all real estate development contracts that I saw here included these very lengthy force majeure clauses. They included everything under the sky, the whole kitchen sink, including subcontractors' failure to perform. And that was what the developers were relying on in arguing to investors why they were not able to perform on time and why there should be no penalty on them to do so, because, you know, it clearly mentioned in the contract that force majeure means, you know, among other things, one of the conditions is a subcontractor's inability to perform. So, and the court said, clearly said, well, just because that's in the contract does not necessarily make that definition, does not necessarily make it so. So that's just an example of how the contract is very helpful, because it helps reduce that ambiguity and helps parties sort of interpret the agreement. And but at the same time, just because the courts will ultimately use their own discretion and their own sort of logic and common sense in terms of determining whether certain events that are included in the definition of force majeure, in fact, actually should qualify as such. Because remember, the legal test, the real test, still is the event unforeseeable, and then plus the performance being sort of impossible to, and then the link between the two. And as I said in this particular example, so the courts would look at that specific contractual provision and apply these three elements, and that one of which is the unforeseeability. And as I said, when you're a real estate developer and you're looking and you're citing the contractor as a third party's inability to perform as a condition to force majeure as part of the definition, the courts obviously say this is not unforeseeable as a business. You should have accounted for that. You should have basically made arrangements in the event these kind of breaches by third parties would occur, because that's the whole nature of a business. Whenever you're relying on third parties, there will always be possibility that that something will go amiss. So just to kind of wrap up that discussion. So if you do not have, even if you don't have in your contract the clause on force majeure, that does not deprive you of the ability to argue it. And that's because it is in the law. One and two, whenever if you were to bring the case to the court, then you can additionally to the provision itself or to the statutory definition, you can also bring out the court cases that would have defined or discussed the force majeure legal doctrine by virtue of laying out all these other conditions. So therefore, if you don't have a contract, you would rely on the statute, the language from the law, and the previous precedents from the courts. If you have the contract, then you have all three sources. You have the contract, you have the law, and you've got the court precedents. So now, in terms of if the parties, and this is, by the way, another question that came up that keeps coming up is, okay, so, and I'm not even sure, to be honest with you, why, like, where that sort of expectation came from, but there's this expectation in the community that in order for any businesses or parties to invoke the force majeure, that somehow there has to be like a statewide or national declaration by the government that this is what's happening in the country is force majeure, and that's an interesting kind of angle, because perhaps I should have expected it, but it comes up so often, it sort of surprised me. But basically, the question is, in order to invoke, in addition to, even if you have a contract, you have the law and you've got this court precedence, is it required for the government to declare a particular event as force majeure to be able to invoke these other sort of legal authorities that we just discussed? And the answer is no. You don't need any sort of declaration from the government or any specific authority. Again, why? Because we'll go back to the underlying legal framework, a foundation of what is force majeure. Force majeure is very case specific, and it's not just case specific, it's very industry specific. It's every transaction, it's transaction to transaction specific. And so that's why it's not required, nor is it necessarily relevant for any kind of government authority to declare or not a particular event, because as we know, in many cases, even in time of crisis, there's always an opportunity somewhere else. Some other businesses can benefit on other people's misery, so to speak, or crises. So just because there is even if there was some sort of declaration of a specific event at a government level to be deemed as force majeure, there's plenty of businesses that in fact are benefiting at the same time. So just because one entity decides that, in their industry it's a force majeure, does not necessarily mean that it is so for other industries or sectors in the industry. And that's why that kind of government declaration is absolutely not required. So, and we've had this, by the way, is that a number of clients have already come and said, listen, we've already looked. We're trying to invoke the force majeure, but we looked high and low to see if the government has declared force majeure, and we haven't seen it yet. So therefore, we believe that it's premature, or we're not in a position to invoke that. Well, now hopefully I've made it clear that this is not at all required, because this is, once again, this is kind of a legal legal doctrine that's based on statutory law and judicial interpretation, and those are sort of the legal criteria that's required for a party to invoke it, and nothing more than that. So what else? So now, in terms of the practical implications, and this is This is a much more kind of specific discussion, and it is not necessarily easy to talk about it in terms of kind of overall industry, and that is because there are so many different. It's such a case by case and such a fact specific exercise that it really depends on specific industry, and even within industry, specific parties' transaction and specific agreements that are signed between them. So that's why, in terms of trying to give it more, like in the context of the current events, you know, if there is some kind of a more robust definition or at least example of what events or what industries will sort of logically or will expectedly be deemed as having been affected by the force majeure, it's not really possible to do. So we'll have to watch that space, and we'll have to see what ends up in court and how the courts ultimately will be interpreting and applying this. Now, the other sort of the next part, okay, so now we've discussed the definition of force majeure. So next is, okay, what does it mean? So if you invoke as a party that's unable and that's in the position of not being able to perform your obligation, what does that mean to the transaction itself? So let's say I need to build a specific computer, for example, and I'm invoking this specific clause of force majeure that on the basis of that some specific, you know, tools or parts that were required for me to rely on to try to build this are just not available because, let's say, they're coming from a country that is now at war, for example, right? So what does that mean? And if the court were to deem that to be truly an event of force majeure, so what does it mean to the underlying transaction? So as per the law, it's an automatic termination of contractual obligations. So, and it's not a partial exemption. It's, and it's not even sort of temporary, at least as the way the law is drafted. Interestingly enough, in fact, if you remember going back to the language of the law, it states that the contract is automatically canceled, you know, by operation of law. And why I say that's interesting is because in the UAE jurisprudence, as compared to other jurisprudence, a contract often, irrespective of what the language of the contract says, it requires a court's decision to cancel it. So even the parties say, like, okay, we have in the event of a breach, you know, the non-breaching party has the remedy or the ability to cancel the contract. The UAE jurisprudence looks at contracts in general, aside from the force majeure, as, okay, well, you may say that, you may agree that in the contract, but ultimately it is up to us, up to the court, to decide whether that contract should be canceled or terminated and under which circumstances, irrespective of what you had agreed on, obviously unless the parties agree without the involvement of the court. So unlike other kind of contractual, just the sort of contractual interpretations and termination of contracts under the UAE jurisprudence, the concept of force majeure, clearly the law clearly states that the contract is automatically canceled, which basically means, at least interpretation-wise, theoretically, that it does not require the court's interpretation or the court's decision to say, yes, that contract is canceled. Obviously, then, if the parties don't agree, you know, let's say the non-breaching party says, well, this is not a force majeure, and in fact, this was not a foreseeable, unforeseeable event, and so on and so forth, that will end up to the court, and the court will decide whether there was an event of force majeure or not. But otherwise, let's say the parties now or face themselves in this situation, and the non-breaching party understands that, yes, in fact, the breaching party cannot perform its obligation because of what's going on, then they don't really need to do much more because the contract, you know, if they agree that, yes, this is a force majeure, then the contract automatically is canceled. And that basically means that party's going to walk away. So the other party, the non-breaching party, is not expected to perform its obligations. So in some jurisdictions, and I kind of actually think that even in the UAE, this would also come up in the right context, is that force majeure sometimes, and in other jurisdictions, it's more spelled out in the law, is that force majeure sometimes, in addition to before the contractual obligation is canceled altogether, sometimes can act as a legal defense measure to delay performance. It's not that the contract is not necessarily canceled, it's just the performance is delayed. So in other words, in many other jurisdictions, force majeure can work in two ways. First, it basically gives the breaching party, the excuse, legitimate excuse to delay their performance during the event of force majeure. And if ultimately things do not change, then the contract becomes terminated. Now, the UAE's law, as I cited, does not necessarily include these two stages. But ultimately, I believe that if that specific question did come up before the local courts, and the party would claim, well, I'm not walking away from the obligations. All I'm saying is that I cannot perform it now because of the event, because it's impossible for me to perform right now. But maybe in a year's time, I will be able to. I do believe that the courts would interpret the current language to give that flexibility, because ultimately it benefits both parties. So now let's talk about what does it mean, this force majeure, in the context of the UAE businesses and the UAE economy and where we are now. So as we all know, in light of the recent regional security and geopolitical developments, some businesses in the UAE, and perhaps many businesses in the UAE, are already experiencing operational disruption and financial pressures. And as a result, many are asking, can we delay performance on existing contracts? Can we exit contracts altogether? What options, what legal options do we have? And specific industries that obviously perhaps the first industries that found themselves on the forefront of these economic challenges are the aviation, hospitality, tourism, and trade dependent industries. And we've already seen a lot of businesses, a lot of requests, a lot of clients expressing exactly that. So that basically they've seen their whole businesses being shut down just by virtue of the country's ultimately borders have been closed to an extent, because the aviation hasn't been disrupted and it's been a lot more limited, and therefore some hospitality and tourism have taken the brunt of it all. And as we know, the UAE, what makes the UAE so magical is because it's a wonderful place to visit, not just to live, but also to visit. And so it depends, and because it's a crossroads and it's connected to these great airlines and smack in the middle of so much of the world, so it's easy to access. So tourism is a huge part of the economy, and it's not just about tourism. It's not just about the airlines. It's the hotels, and it's the restaurants. It's all the F&B that sort of feed into the tourism, and it's all the activities, the desert safaris, and all the parks and all the other kind of tourist activities that usually bring millions of people into the UAE to visit, not just the residents, but tourists. And so the tourists now, even though the flights have resumed, at least Emirates Airlines and Etihad Airlines, they are flying, but they're perhaps flying less for purposes of bringing tourists and more for shuttling residents. So therefore, the whole basically the tourism industry is obviously taking a serious brunt of it all. And then we're talking about hotels, and then we're also talking about real estate, because what does that mean? So there's a lot of business models in the UAE. Kind of real estate is, for example, a short term. The whole businesses are sort of set up on renting properties. Apartments, villas, and from owners, and then kind of and renting them out on a short-term basis through Airbnb and such. And so all those businesses obviously being directly affected as well. It's kind of impact is certainly is is there, and it's impacted a lot of businesses faster than others. But slowly, we're seeing that a lot more businesses are being directly and materially affected. And so the questions that we see in terms of at least the clients that we've sort of we've experienced so far is in particular with real estate. I mean, apart from tourism and a lot of the contracts that being breached or being canceled, for example, wedding events. We've had a number of clients that had planned wedding events in the UAE and have now had to cancel because of these events. So you see, it's not just the tourism per se, it's a lot of the events. And unfortunately, this is the time right now, this is our typical time in the UAE for hosting events, you know, conferences and all sorts of international events and that have historically brought, you know, perhaps, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of tourists just during the season for purposes of events. And so, again, we're talking about hotels, airlines, F&Bs, but also these others, you know, all the auxiliary services that would supply services to this different types of demographic of tourists. So that is one industry, but the other industry is real estate, right? And that's where we're seeing a lot from just from the perspective of individuals, right? And there we have two types of real estate. One is investors that are buying or in the process of buying, those are the ones that are perhaps a little more kind of imminent right now. And then there are some from the rental perspective, so those who are renting. So from the perspective of the real estate investors, you know, those ones already own properties. I mean, so for the time being, they are at least secure. So they've got properties that are in their name, and many of them they either live in or they're rented. So those ones are not sort of immediately being affected the same way as, for example, those real estate transactions which are kind of in the process or which were about to be formalized or finalized. So, for example, we've had a flurry of questions and clients who were in the process of, you know, either paying a deposit or pay the deposit or issued a check, a deposit check, or, you know, signed the sort of SBAs or the MOUs and the Form Fs and sort of committed to purchase a property, and now because of the circumstances basically ultimately want to walk away. And so there are questions like, well, you know, can we legally walk away? Well, and that's a perfect perhaps context in to discuss some of the specific force majeure elements that we talked about earlier. And that is, well, just because you're worried about the overall health of the UAE real estate market, does not necessarily make you unable to enter into the transaction. Yeah, well, you think from commercially, it may no longer be worthwhile for you to carry on with this transaction, but that's not an appropriate element to invoke force majeure. So just because you think that, well, by the time, let's say, you know, from the time that you made the offer on the property and the time that this will potentially close, the property will drop in value by whatever percentage, that in of itself is not that sort of element of impossibility, right? It does not render your performance impossible. It's just inconvenient because it will commercially less appealing. So that is not the right element to invoke force majeure. Now, what is a good example? Let's say some of these contracts have a specific provision or condition to proceeding with a transaction, with purchasing the property, and that is the buyer's ability to source a mortgage, right? Either a mortgage or financing. And so sometimes some of these agreements are very specific about, well, so this contract is, or this transaction is contingent on the buyer's ability to actually obtain the mortgage or financing. And all of a sudden, the buyer loses the job, or the bank says, well, you know, listen, we need these additional documents to prove your financial worthiness to be able to issue with the document that to help you get the mortgage. And so that would be an example of where that's, I guess, a legitimate example or reason or ground for an investor to just say, listen, I cannot carry on with this transaction because it's impossible for me to get that NOC from the bank to proceed. And that's, you know, and then obviously, you know, here it's interesting because you have two, potentially two different legal arguments. One is contractual, because in the contract itself, it says, well, this agreement is specifically conditioned on the buyer's ability to obtain financing. But a lot of the agreements are not drafted that specifically. So therefore, if your agreement is not drafted that specifically, but alludes to the financing or your sort of your liquidity, this is where you can bring in the argument of force majeure. So this, well, it obviously, my ability, my financial liquidity is a necessary element to be able to pursue this transaction, as is mentioned in the agreement. And now I am, you have just lost a job, so I have no ability to fund this. So there, you know, there could be an argument of force majeure. Again, it's very, very fact specific, and this is why we kept going back to, you know, ideas. This is why also legislators did not really add any more to the statutory definition of force majeure, because it's so sort of case specific. Even in that example that I just gave you, it really depends on the specific sort of the nuances of a specific transaction and specific parties' agreement and the parties' sort of specific circumstances. So that's basically, but that's, you know, where we're seeing a lot of perhaps question right now from investors to try to invoke force majeure to try to exit their real estate transactions using this force majeure doctrine. And, you know, it's very important for us to explain, and then we do explain to them, listen, if you can actually invoke, if it's truly impossible, then absolutely, the law is there, those tools are there. But just because you think, and we've had plenty of those as well, just because you think that the property market is now softer and you could get the same property for less shortly or soon, that in itself is not an argument. So therefore, and that's not to say that you can't exit or cancel the transaction. You still may, but then it becomes, it's not on the basis of force majeure, it's just because basically you're breaching your agreement, and then it becomes between you, the investor, and the seller to decide, so what's the penalty for your breach. And what we have seen, and this is sort of separate from the force majeure discussion, but what we have seen a lot of parties do, which makes sense, is that in a lot of these cases, buyers believe that the deposit of 10% is a little excessive to pay as a penalty to the seller, as in light of the current circumstances. And there have been plenty of reasonable sellers that we deal with who understand the circumstances, and therefore they don't expect the 10%, but they agree on some other sum. So that's, you know, that would be kind of a reasonable and commercially viable and sort of a mutually beneficial way to deal with these transactions. So where the seller understands the circumstances and you does not kind of expect, or how do you force somebody to go ahead with the transaction that they really just don't want to go through? And instead of insisting on this, the 10% as a penalty, which is sort of, it's not a customary, I don't want to say it's customary because it's just kind of developed as a practice, but it's not mandated by law, this the 10% deposit that's used as penalty in the event the parties breach. But there's some other amount that obviously can be negotiated and that is mutually beneficial that will also not require going to court. So that's basically in the context of real estate transactions. Now, that's real estate investments. Now, with regards to rental contracts, and that's another industry, sort of a segment of the real estate industry that we have seen kind of a flurry of questions and concerns about. And it's people who are renting properties, in particular from tenants, who are unable to pay or carry on with rent. And they could be residential tenants, could be commercial tenants. And it's all because of, let's say, if you are a commercial and we've had these a commercial tenant and you are in a short-term rent that's tailored and for tourism industry, and you have sort of no tourists right now, so your industry, you know, obviously your whole business is being affected. You want these contracts that you've signed with the landlords on the basis of your expectation to be able to rent them out on a short-term basis. Now you're not able to fund because your revenue stream all of a sudden just stopped. So we've seen those kinds of requests and issues. And then on the other hand, with just individual investors or individual tenants, you know, people who work and live here and they've committed to rents and they're renting properties and all of a sudden they've lost their jobs. Companies not paying on time. So there's these kind of two different sources of, tenants or different types of tenants and different sort of trends, all of which is understandable and we can sympathize with their cause. And then because it's a business, so how do you carry on paying for your obligations, your rental obligations, particularly if your entire industry is dependent on tourism that has for the time being stopped? Or as a tenant, how do you pay, make your next rent payment if you've lost your job, and even worse if both income earners in the household also lost their jobs. So it's very, very difficult. And so this is a little outside the subject of this conversation, but the point here is, could you claim force majeure? It depends on, as I mentioned earlier, on specific circumstances that you may be able to claim force majeure. But the moral of the story and the advice I have for basically all parties is to agree on some sort of a reasonable and commercially sensible way for the parties to either renegotiate their current relationship or to allow for them to terminate it. And that's because if a person lost their job, how are they going to pay for rent? I mean, you can chase them, and that's going to cost the landlord money and legal fees and time and headache. And still the person doesn't have money to pay because they have no job, for example. So ultimately, yes, you may have this judgment, and just enforcing this judgment may take you a long time or you may never be able to enforce it. So I guess the practical recommendation here is for the parties to understand the situation, to be sympathetic to each other's cause. And as I've said, we have plenty of clients who have been able to negotiate from different angles. We're all in this together, so people do understand that these are kind of extraordinary and difficult times for everybody. So I guess the advice here is to be reasonable, to be sensible, and to be sympathetic to each other's positions and to negotiate and come up with something, even if it means a reduction in rent. And by the way, we've seen this before during COVID time. Even if it's a 50% reduction in rent, there's different ways of memorializing this just to make it temporary. And there's ways to even kind of to recoup some of the difference when the situation improves. So it's contractually can all be managed, but in any event, instead of going to court and arguing this force majeure or not force majeure, my recommendation is for the parties to sit down and come up with a commercially reasonable arrangement and document it in a way that they can restore their ability to transact in the previous terms once the situation improves. So in conclusion, force majeure is often seen as kind of as a legal escape route in times of uncertainty, but in reality, under the UAE law and most other sort of jurisdictions, it's a fairly narrow and a strictly applied doctrine. It is not enough that the market has shifted or the business conditions have worsened or that circumstances have become inconvenient or financially burdensome. So the legal threshold remains clear. The event must be unforeseeable, the impact must render performance impossible, and there must be a direct causal link between the two. Only when all of these elements are satisfied will force majeure apply. And when it does, the consequence is serious and final, and the contract is brought to an end. So across real estate, rental agreements, and commercial contracts, the same principles hold. Each case is fact-specific. Each outcome depends on the contract and the actual impact. And in many situations, force majeure will not apply, but that does not mean that the parties are without options. In practice, the most effective approach is often early assessment of each other's legal position, clear communication with counterparties, and just practical negotiations where possible. That's all for this episode of Logical with Ludmila. If you found this episode useful and you like what we do, you can always find more on our website. That's lylawyers.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And for the full experience, you can also watch us on YouTube. Until next time, stay informed, stay safe, and keep things logical.